Très bien. Donc, nous connaissons, commençons la première séance de ce colloque, cette matinée, où nous avons un vaste espace à parcourir d'Occident en Orient et aussi une vaste période chronologique de l'Antiquité grecque jusqu'à l'époque des Lumières. Et donc, nous aurons le temps de voir tout cela en détail et je donne sans tarder, puisque nous sommes parfaitement à l'heure, la parole au professeur Jeffrey Lloyd, qui a été professeur de philosophie ancienne et de sciences à l'université de Cambridge pendant des années, qui a été master de Darwin College et dont la spécialité, vous l'avez déjà deviné, c'est la science dans l'Antiquité, mais avec la grande originalité de l'avoir étudié en Grèce, ce qui est trivial, pourrions-nous dire, dans le monde universitaire, mais aussi en Chine, et d'avoir comparé les deux, ce qui était une petite révolution. Jeffrey, donc je vous donne la parole. Vous parlerez anglais, je crois, mais il y a des traductions simultanées. The button, the green button.
Okay. Well, I apologize for speaking English, but you have excellent translators, and I suppose it's more economical for me to speak English. And first of all, I would like to thank Philippe Descola for inviting me and giving me this chance to put before you some controversial, but I think perhaps important, historical points. Let me first outline the structure of my brief remarks here. I'll begin by rehearsing what I believe to be the key points about the development and use of the concept of phusis in early Greek thought. I'll turn next to consider how the ancient Chinese dealt with the problems that the Greeks discussed under that rubric, where my chief claim is that the Chinese had no single overarching concept that covered everything that the Greek term phusis did. Thirdly, that will lead me back to the Greek materials to investigate some of the ambivalences and tensions in their uses of that term before finally I discuss what this means for the legacy of Greek thought for later, including even contemporary, European ideas. So part one. The essential points I've argued for where early Greek thought is concerned can be summed up under seven heads. One. Initially, that is, in the earliest extant Greek literature, there's no single overarching concept that corresponds to the later phusis. There's just one use of the term in Homer, when a god, Hermes, shows Odysseus a plant, where its phusis seems to cover what it is like and or how it grows. For grows is the primary sense of words derived from the verb phunai, to grow. Besides, this is a magical plant which will protect Odysseus from the spells of Circe. The term certainly doesn't pick out nature as a domain of investigation. Two, that is what it does do in several of the earliest pre-Socratic philosophers who came to be called phusikoi or physiologoi and whose works were called periphusios historia, the inquiry into nature, a title that in some cases goes back to the original authors themselves. Thirdly, those early Greek philosophers often discuss individual phenomena, including many that had been associated with divine intervention, where by contrast the philosophers give naturalistic explanations. Thus, Xenophanes says of the rainbow, Iris, but Iris was also conceived as a messenger from the gods, that it is just a cloud. Fourthly, in many cases, the knowledge the philosophers themselves claim to possess is contrasted strongly with the ignorant opinions and conventional views of the many. For Heraclitus, nature loves to hide. It takes someone special, like Heraclitus himself, to say how things really are. Fifthly, we can trace similar developments in early Greek medical texts. Most famously, the Hippocratic treatise on the sacred disease offers a naturalistic account of that disease in strong contrast to what the people he calls purifiers claimed. They associated that disease with gods, and even offered specific diagnoses of different types of the disease, relating them to specific deities. By contrast, this author says that this disease, like every other, has its nature, phusis, and its cause. For cause, the author uses aitia, among other terms, where the basic sense of aitios is responsible. That's a term whose use spans legal guilt and natural cause, but phusis, the other word the treatise uses in its polemic, is distinctive of the naturalistic approach of medical writers who insist that there's no need to invoke gods to explain diseases. Sixthly, by the 4th century BCE, Periphusios Historia is well established as the domain over which the phusikoi, naturalists, claim to be acknowledged experts. And it has as its departments the study of animals, such as Aristotle's Historia Animalium, or plants, Theophrastus, or minerals, while Aristotle, of course, offers a general account of phusis itself, where he discusses causation in general, though this is certainly not physics in the modern sense. Seventhly, thereafter, phusikē is one of the three main branches of philosophy, along with ethics and logic. Even the Hellenistic skeptics, who abstained from speculation about underlying reality and hidden causes, continued to assume that natural phenomena had their regular natures. So that's part one. Part two. My claim is that the ancient Chinese from the Warring States to the end of the Han, that's from the 2nd century BCE to the 2nd CE, had no single overarching concept that did the work of Greek phusis. The term used in modern Chinese for nature, dadzuran, is derived from a word the Japanese used once they were familiar with Western concepts, and so is a much later development. So if we ask how the ancient Chinese dealt with the issues the Greeks used phusis to discuss, we must accept that the answers are many and diverse. In one context, the Chinese speculated about change using the concept of the five phases or five agents, wuxing. In another, they discussed what happens spontaneously, zuran, that is, without human intervention. In a third, they speculated about the origins of the myriad things, wanwu, or just things, wu. In a fourth, they investigated the relationships between heaven, earth, and man, humans, tian, di, ren. In other contexts, they were interested in the patterns of things, li, and of course the Tao, is the goal of many projects, not so much a matter of intellectual knowledge as of embodying the way. Again, the term jing, originally used of fine rice, is invoked when discussing the real character of things, their essence, one might say. And there was a heated debate in the 4th and 3rd centuries BCE on whether humans are good, bad, or indifferent, where the fundamental issue is one of morality. Professor Cheng will talk about that tomorrow, I believe. In that context, the term used is xing, which is translatable as human nature. But we must be careful. When the Lu Shi Chunqiu, a compendium put together in the 3rd century before the Common Era, speaks of the xing of water, it identifies this as purity, being clear, qing. When it goes on to say that the xing of humans, run, is long life, shou, it's obvious that this author is not trying to define the physical nature of water or of humanity, but rather setting out an ideal in each case, the character of the thing in question when it is at its best. We can see then that the Chinese have a rich vocabulary to deploy when discussing problems where the ancient Greeks might have talked of phusis. But it is essential to see that the Chinese, unlike the Greeks, were not tempted to run all those issues together to consider them all part of a single problematic, nature. We may slip into the assumption that you cannot do natural science, nor even philosophy, without some such basic concept as nature, but the Chinese evidence gives us the lie, for they got on perfectly well in different contexts, defining the issues differently in each. Yet a second note of caution needs to be struck. To say that the ancient Chinese had no concept equivalent to nature or to physics is not, of course, to say that they didn't appreciate the regularities in the phenomena. They appreciated for sure that to obtain a crop, you needed to sow seed. They gave increasingly accurate estimates of the length of the solar year and the lunar month, and were in a position to predict lunar and eventually also solar eclipses. But if they had implicit understanding of what we call nature, they didn't make explicit that all the different domains they were interested in formed part of a single inquiry, the investigation into nature, Periphusios Historia. Besides, importantly, the individuals who did the work didn't mark themselves out, nor were they distinguished by others, as physikoi, naturalists. Of course, Chinese experts in particular domains did claim superior knowledge, but it was not nature as such that they were experts in, but rather the study of the patterns in the heavens, Tianwen in one case, in mathematics, Shu Shu in another, in agriculture in a third, and so on. The upshot of my first two sections is to draw a broad contrast between a synthesizing Greek tendency to focus on physis as the chief issue and the Chinese assumption of differentiation between different domains and projects. But that, of course, tends to mask where the problems with Greek physis lie. It's time to focus on some of these. So that's my second part. Some water. Okay, part three. Let me identify two principal ones, problems, for the sake of this summary discussion. First, the multiple contexts in which some contrast is drawn between nature, physis, and nomos, which covers law, custom, and convention, all rather different things. And secondly, the problems inherent in the demarcation of the two domains of inquiry, physics, or at least physikē, and ethics. In the former case, the Greeks puzzled over what accounts for differences between different human populations, perceived or at least imagined as possessing markedly different physical characteristics and sets of dispositions. Herodotus, as much to say on the topic, as does the Hippocratic treatise on airs, waters, places. The problems are particularly clear in the latter case when that author deploys two quite contrasting modes of explanation. In chapter 16, he's concerned with the differences in character between those he calls Asiatics, that's to say people who inhabit what we now call Asia Minor, and Europeans. The chief reason, he writes, why Asiatics are less warlike and more gentle in character than Europeans, interesting remark in view of contemporary assumptions, is the uniformity of the seasons, which show no violent changes either towards heat or towards cold, but are equable. But he immediately goes on to say that their institutions, laws, nomoi, are an additional factor. Where humans are not independent but ruled by despots and do not fight on their own behalf, they avoid appearing to be warlike. And he offers evidence for this, claiming that where Asiatics, whether Greeks or barbarians, are not ruled by despots, they're the most warlike of human beings. You can see the tension, even the inconsistency, in his position. If human character depends on climate, you would expect that everyone who shared the same climate would have the same character. But given that different people living in Asia do vary in how warlike they are, that undermines the ecological explanation. Conversely, if political regimes are the determining factor, they should be unaffected by climate. The Hippocratic author has boxed himself in. He is not content with either a physicalist explanation on its own or on a political one, but he does little to resolve how they are to be combined and reconciled. A second major controversy that swirls around the two terms physis and nomos relates to the foundations of morality itself. The ancient Greeks were very well aware that customs and conventions differ. So too were the ancient Chinese. But the question that they debated quite furiously was whether any of them, indeed any notions of right and wrong, had any natural basis. The realists, or cynics, flatly denied this. One view, represented by the character Callicles in Plato's Gorgias, has it that the laws were instituted by the weak in a forlorn attempt to curb the aggressions of the strong. A second variant of the anti-objectivist position is expressed by Thrasymachus in Plato's Republic, according to which the laws were created by the strong to give a veneer of legitimacy to their appropriations of power. According to nature, indeed, according to the law of nature, might is right. Justice is simply a matter of what the strong decide is such. That is the position of the Athenians in the Melian debate in Thucydides, where the poor Melians vainly protest that their behavior towards them is quite unjust. Against these attacks on the objective basis of morality, two lines of argument were mounted. Some claimed that there were exceptions to the rule that laws are society-specific. There are, it was claimed, unwritten laws that apply to all humans, as Antigone argued when she buried her brother against the prohibition of Creon in Sophocles' play. But while such texts as Xenophon's Memorabilia show how common the idea of such unwritten laws was, they also reveal just how difficult it was to specify what they were. In an exchange between Hippias and Socrates in that work, even the favorite example of the prohibition of incest is undermined by the observation that it is not universally observed. A second line of argument was equally difficult to sustain. This was Plato's view that injustice harms you. It's like a disease, though far worse, since it damages not your body but your soul. The psychology that underpins this was not the only controversial point, for the metaphysics was even more so. Plato, after all, insisted that there are eternal, intelligible forms of goodness, beauty, and yes, justice. What might seem just to one person in one respect might be unjust to another in another, but justice itself is eternal and unchanging, a transcendental guarantee of the objectivity that was so badly threatened by the contrast between nature and convention. But evidently, to accept Plato's view that the true natures were the intelligible forms, one had to buy into a considerable package of counterintuitive propositions. I should be returning later to just how much influence such a philosophy may be supposed to have had among the ancient Greeks themselves. My second example to illustrate the problems of Greek physis relates to the boundary between what they called physics and what they labeled ethics. Aristotle, ever keen on defining the different subject matters and methods of different disciplines, is clear that ethics and politics deal with moral virtue and political institutions. What marks out humans from other animals, for Aristotle, is that we, adults at least, possess moral choice, prohairesis. So far, you might say, so good. But then the complications begin. Physis is not just a descriptive term, but also a normative one. Humans are by nature, phuze, political animals, politica. Aristotle knows very well that the majority of humans don't live in polis, city-states, but he still claims it's our nature to do so, since the polis is the ideal human community to which all human collectivities, from the family upwards, aspire. Aristotle's teleological view of nature permeates not just his politics, but also his investigations of animals. To give just a single striking example, In the bodies of living beings, up is defined as the place at which nourishment is taken in. Our mouths are at the top of our bodies, so we're natural. But in quadrupeds, up is at the front of their bodies, where their mouths are. In plants, it's where their roots are. So plants are upside down. Other living beings are judged by how closely they approximate to the model provided by humans. They are, in some cases, labeled deformed or maimed. And of course, notoriously, he judged females as somehow inferior males. They failed to concoct the blood to make semen in the way males do. There's no whisper of a suggestion that males fail in not producing menstrual blood, let alone babies. So that's the end of part three. I could continue, but I hope to have said enough to make the point, excuse me, that while the ancient Greeks used physis to carve out a domain of investigable, as we say, natural phenomena, the concept was anything but uncontroversial for them as well as for us, and anything but innocent or value-free. I hope, too, to have said enough to point up some differences between the Greek and Chinese approaches to problems that are, in certain respects at least, broadly similar, which one could illustrate not just with what we can call the study of the heavens, but also with the differences between different human populations, between humans and other animals, and so on. Much more could and should be said about each of these, but my agenda in this final section of my paper is rather to scrutinize the Greek legacy. Of course, Greek notions of nature didn't go unchallenged, nor pass unchanged into later European culture. One major transformation occurred when the Greco-Roman world was converted to Christianity. Then the second major topic for our agenda relates to the rise of the ontology that Descola has labeled naturalism. A word or two on the first before I conclude with some remarks on the second. Christianity took over a good deal from pagan Greek ideas, but generally transformed whatever it appropriated from that source. Of course, the pagan Greeks had their demiurges, craftsmen gods, including impersonal ones. But they didn't create the world ex nihilo, nor were they capable of overruling nature with miracles. Galen complains against Moses that God would never have dreamt of any such thing. Miracles are out. And we have seen the Greeks drew a sharp distinction between humans and the other animals. But although there's one exceptional text in Aristotle's Politics that suggests that plants are for the sake of the animals and the other animals for the sake of humans, that goes against the normal rule in Greek teleology that each living being has the form and function it has for its own benefit, not for that of other creatures. The story in Genesis, by contrast, stresses that the other animals are there to be ruled over and used by humans. Above all, the principal aim of philosophizing has shifted. Understanding is no longer to be cultivated for its own sake. We don't need inquiry, we need faith, Tertullian. Rather, the focus must be on the salvation of your immortal soul in an afterlife where the contrast between the fates of the saved and of the damned is depicted far more terrifyingly than in any pagan Greek author. Cosmological and theological beliefs had, to be sure, a massively complex fortuna in later centuries. But I turn in conclusion to the thorny question of where we've got to now, with or after modernity. I've gone on about the differences between ancient Greek and ancient Chinese ideas. But in Descola's analysis, both these regimes count as analogistic. Both are to be contrasted with naturalist ontology, which is the default position of modernity. Now, Descola's ontological schemata are defined by the contrasting stances taken on physicality and interiority. What marks out naturalism is the assumption that physicality is continuous across humans and animals. We're all made of the same stuff, but interiority is discontinuous. Humans alone have culture. In analogistic regimes, both physicality and interiority are discontinuous across different creatures, but are linked with networks of analogies and correspondences. It's important to recognize that such a focus on physicality and interiority tackles the problems at a far deeper level of experience than the kind of debates between different philosophical positions that have been my own chief concern. Descola's evidence that allows him to treat both ancient Greeks and ancient Chinese as examples of analogistic regimes relates to such factors as religious practice, assumptions about social and other relations, and even to art. The philosophers' varying speculations don't affect the underlying belief systems of the cultures to which they belonged. Indeed, it can be argued that neither Greek nor Chinese philosophical theorizing fundamentally influenced the values and patterns of behavior that governed the lives of the communities to which they belonged. By contrast, one can and should say that both Greek and Chinese societies were quite radically affected by religious conversion to Christianity on the one hand, Buddhism on the other. That's a long and complex story in both cases. On the one hand, the differences we can remark in the level and focus of the analysis, in Descola on the one hand, in certain historical studies, my own included, on the other, should help us to avoid certain misunderstandings. I plead guilty to some myself in the past. On the other, as a philosopher and historian, I still have a raft of questions that require further examination. How did naturalism emerge? How does any ontological schema get its grip? And what did it and does it owe to much earlier ideas of nature? The Greeks, after all, anticipated the notion that there is a single stuff or stuffs of which all things are made, though what modern physics would say about that stuff is, as I said, miles away from any ancient debates on the matter of which tables and chairs and plants and animals are all made. Then secondly, have we sufficiently emancipated ourselves from the legacy of those ideas? Are we not still hung up on the contrast between nature and nurture, so obstructive in discussions of human development? And some of us still even on nature and culture themselves, which par-delà works to get beyond. If nature carries with it a baggage that contaminates naturalism, how far can we simply do without it? Can we contemplate an ethology, a biology, an anthropology, a cosmology, a physics, an ethics that simply do away with nature? If only we could honestly say, we have never been naturalists. Actually, the ancient Chinese could say that, though contemporary ones find it hard to resist the invasive forces of naturalism. That suggestion that nature has had its day will strike many scientists especially as a pretty shocking one. Aren't the natural sciences, as we call them, united in their presupposition that they investigate different aspects of the one nature using what is dubbed the scientific method? Well, that method, or rather the methods, plural, in question, certainly differ according to the subject matter, and invoking the concept of nature may distract us from paying due attention to those differences in the subject matters themselves. In some fields, the notions that there are natural kinds may look robust enough, but in others it can be adopted only at the cost of eliding some difficult questions. After Hacking's 2007 article, which was entitled Natural Kinds, Rosy Dawn, Scholastic Twilight, we should surely not be complacent about the viability of that concept across the board. True, we seek and find regularities within each branch of science, and even, courtesy of analogies indeed, across them. But given the baggage of nature, in its mixing the descriptive with the normative, its often naive realistic presuppositions, the task of unmasking it is still disappointingly incomplete. For that project, historical studies of the variety of belief systems and practices actually attested for ancient societies need to join forces with the ontological explorations that have recently had such a vogue in anthropology. And surely such an endeavor stands to learn much from our investigations in this colloque. My hopes are high.